Well, those who have been in satsang with me, and I bring you up to speed, know that I have not very much interest in spiritual matters. I don't have much interest in spiritual experiences. I have no desire to transmit to you any experience of awakening or peace or bliss or eternal love or anything of the sort. I don't have any interest in the metaphysical understanding of the way the cosmos manifests. In fact, my interest in spiritual things is pretty narrow and simple. So far as I can see in my experience, in my own personal experience, as well as my experience with the people I've been meeting with over the last 7 years or so, it's my experience that we all have, for the most part, wandered far afield from the simplicity of the truth that has been announced to us and offered to us time and time again since the beginning of humanity. It seems to be the nature of the human mind to go far afield from the simplicity of what's real. You know, we really like our thoughts. We really like the feel of ourselves in our minds. We really like seeking after pleasure and avoiding pain. Even in the spiritual arena, we spend most of our time, in my experience, seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. There comes a time in our lives when we are taken by spiritual aspiration, which is to replace the worldly aspirations that have done us so good up until then, the aspirations for comfort and pleasure, relationship, love, power, fame, so forth. There comes a time in our lives when we see that these things have been useless to us, really, fundamentally. I mean, it's useful enough to have a nice place to live and have good things and good friends and good relationships and so forth, but really they don't cut it. It's not enough. Still, I am unsatisfied. I suffer or impose suffering on others to the extent that I am convinced that my satisfaction and dissatisfaction arises from what others do, what I can get, what I can't get. But even if I'm not so crazy as to blame the world for my misery, I remain miserable in a nest of affluence and good things. So I become a spiritual aspirant. And what I receive, for the most part, is all of the reaction and response and explanation and interpretation that has arisen from the really simple, radical, naked suggestion that comes from those who have seen it. And what we hear are all the commentary on that, all the wondrous experiences that have come to people as a result of being in the company of these awakened ones, these mighty ones, all their explanations and their interpretations for how that came to pass and what you can do to get the same thing for yourself. That's mostly what we receive when we come to the spiritual arena from the first time. But the truth is that all of that, all of those things that we hear and all of the good experiences that we get really are just more of the same thing that we have been doing all our life, seeking pleasure, avoiding pain, wanting to find something that will heal me, that will close the wound of lack and neediness that's in my heart. And like we have always done, we are willing to take what we can get. So we go to spiritual meetings and we receive these energetic transmissions of peace and love and bliss and harmony. And we're satisfied with that, as we have in the past been satisfied with, oh, a better paycheck or a better partner or something. And of course, these gifts of grace that come to us, they, since they have appeared, since there was a time when they were not here, and then there was a time when they are here, we can be certain, and we are certain in our heart of hearts, that there will be a time when they are not here. Still, we chase after them. We get some satisfaction with a good, well-expounded explanation for reality, a metaphysical understanding, something about the way consciousness manifests in the world. We get some satisfaction from that, and we bank that too. But it doesn't last, the satisfaction. And the reason is, in my experience and in my estimation, is because we are grazing about in the weeds that have grown from the clear, simple, radical suggestion that has been made to us from the beginning from those who have seen it. And we've satisfied ourselves with the flowers and the scents and the weeds that have grown around these gigantic beings. So far as I can see, all spiritual expression, whether it is the most serious and advanced spiritual expression, or is the least serious and advanced spiritual expression, like Christianity or Islam or Judaism or any of the major religions, all of them have at their core, in their heart, the same insight. It is difficult to see it when what we are looking at, whether we are looking at the advanced versions or the infantile versions, it's difficult to see the flame that's at the heart, the core of these things, because we are distracted by all of the show and the sense and the sounds and the feelings and the aversion and the wishing, desire. But all of them have the same insight at their heart, the same, which is that there is not two of anything anywhere to be found, which is received most often by the expression all is one. But really it's that there's not two anywhere to be found. There is no separate entity to be found anywhere at all in any realm. And that's a sweet insight. And it feels good when we kind of get the gist of it. It feels good not to. All is one. No separation. We would like for it to be so. But our experience, our actual experience in the world, belies that. It tells us that there is nothing but separation, that all things are separate, that the world consists in a menagerie of conflicting entities and conflicting needs, and which have to be negotiated or snuffed out. Our experience tells us something different. So we like the feeling of the insight that all is one, and we are certainly willing to proclaim that. But it doesn't end the lack, the neediness, the aggression, the self-betrayal. It It's just one more thing that we can try to hold on to and try to suck it dry. But there's another thing, another insight that is at the core of all the spiritual expressions whatsoever. There are several of them. But another insight that's at the core is this. And you must recognize this. Anyone who has come to this level of spiritual aspiration that is present in this room must recognize this. And that is that the cause of all of our suffering, the cause of all of our misery, the cause of all aggression, all hatred, all murderous intent, all confusion, all neediness whatsoever, is this. We are not who we think we are. We are ruled by a false belief about our nature. And that this belief is so deeply embedded in our consciousness that it actually is the engine of human individual consciousness and human behavior, this belief that I know what I am and that what I am is this storyline that has been running for as long as I can remember. I mean, that's what makes it me, is that it's been running as long as I can remember. And this story consists in memory, history, what I did, who my parents were, what they thought about things, what church I was a part of, what political ideas I have, what's right, what's wrong, what thoughts of mine are useful, what thoughts of mine are harmful, what are the negative feelings that come, the understanding of what's negative, the understanding of what's positive, the understanding of what's peaceful, the understanding of what's hurtful. All of these things, more and more and more, constitute the story of me that I know I have the most invisible, firm belief is me. And there's nothing whatsoever in any spiritual practice that I have seen, any meditation practice, any affirmation practice, any mantra practice, any therapeutic practice, any spiritual practice that I have seen, or worldly practice for that matter, that can rid myself of this fundamental mistake, which is the belief that what I am is the story of me. Because all the practices, of course, what they do is they just become part of the story of me. All my attainments become part of the story of me. All my failures become part of the story of me. What I need to change, what I need to keep, what needs to be made sweeter, what needs to be gotten rid of, what I need to affirm, what I need to deny, what I need to do, what I need to do to quiet my mind, to shut down this story. In the end, for most of us, that's as far as we can get. What can I do to shut this incessant racket up? To finish it. And we find ways of doing that. I mean, really, it's not as hard as we make it out to be in our advanced spiritual understandings. The truth is that the story and the racket itself starts and stops endlessly, incessantly. But we find ways to make it happen at our will. We find meditation practices. We find teachers and teachings that can transmit to us some quiet mind. It doesn't last, of course. Mind is quiet now. There is no thought present now. But I know, which itself is a thought, that in the next moment, the whole river will come rushing back. I know it because that's my experience. It's not because somebody told me that. It's because that's my experience. I have had lengthy intervals of absolute quiet mind. Doesn't last. Next thing I know, I turn around and here I am again. What am I going to do now? What should I do? What does this mean, the fact that mind is quiet? What can I do with this? How can I make this a part of my awakening? How can I make this permanent? God knows what stories we tell. These are my stories. How can I shut this up once and for all? And of course, this aspiration, the aspiration to silence the mind once and for all, is perhaps the most common aspiration once a certain level of understanding is reached. You know, we know that there are ways and practices by which ego can be eradicated. And that's what we want. We want ego to go away. Because ego is, right? All this thought, all this fussing, all this nonsense, all this wanting, all this getting and keeping and not keeping. So we want ego to go away. We want thought to go away. Finally, we know what we want. Finally. And we get pretty busy with it. And we find all kinds of practices and teachings and transmissions and so forth that promise in our understanding of things, that promise to give us this quietness, this silence, promise to end the conflict that is the essential nature of what I am. I know that. That's what I know. What I am is this endless conflict, this endless river of thought. And if I want to kill ego, well, that's just me wanting to kill ego. If I want mind to be quiet, well, that's just me wanting mind to be quiet. But what is not questioned is this me that wants ego dead, that wants mind quietened, that wants peace, that wants the sweetness of spiritual experience, spiritual opening. The lovey-dovey feeling of it all. I know what I want. I know what I want to get rid of. But I don't have a clue what I am. Well, actually, if I am really spiritual, I probably have lots of ideas about what I am. I am infinite consciousness. I am, eternal love. I am emptiness. I am Buddha mind. I'm nothing. But the heart of all of the spiritual teachings is this. All of my problems, all of my desire to have the mind quiet when it is not quiet, all of my desire for silence and love and open-heartedness and empty mind, all of that is predicated on a false belief about what I am. Just as all of my efforts to find happiness in the world of material things has been predicated on a false belief of what I am. And it is absolutely for certain that if what I want has anything whatsoever to do with the nature of my behavior, with the nature of my thoughts, with the nature of my experience, with the nature of my aspirations, anything whatsoever to do with me, the result is suffering and misery and self-hatred. So we are told that we are happiness itself. We are told that we are consciousness itself. We are told that we are eternal and permanent, the shining face of awareness that never changes, that never moves, that never suffers, that never inflicts suffering. And we try to become that. We are told that all of our problems stem from a false belief about what we are. So we try to become something different. We try to adopt some new belief about what we are. I mean, this is just what we do. This is the remarkable thing about the appearance of Ramana Maharshi in our lives, in this time, in this period of the history of humanity. Ramana Maharshi had no interest whatsoever in anything we were doing. He had no desire whatsoever to change our practices. For example, he never told Papaji to stop getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning and doing Japa to Krishna. He never told Papaji that that was a waste of time and really didn't have much of anything to do except to keep Papaji busy and sleepless. He never told those who came to him in the practice of pranayama or mantra or any of the other things that their practice was wrong, that the problem had to do with their practice. He never told anybody that the problem that caused suffering in their lives had something to do with their thoughts or their negative emotions or their aggressive impulses. He never told them any of that. He never had any interest in any of that. If he could help somebody, he did. If he could help somebody with their pranayama, he did. But he really wasn't interested in any of that. He was interested in only one thing, so far as I can see, and that is to offer to us, to urge us, to pray that we will just stop for 1 second and find out what we are. Because you see, what Ramana saw is that the only solution to the false belief about what I am is the truth of what I am. There is no other solution to the problem of human existence apart from the truth of what I am. None. Everything else is just waiting for the grave. Everything else is making the nest a little better. And that's okay. There's no problem with that. You don't need to do away with that. You don't need to fix that. It's not wrong. It just won't give you what you think it will. And none of our spiritual aspirations will give us what we think it will. The only thing that will give us what we want is the truth. Nothing else. The simple, naked, radical truth of what I am. And that eradicates the false belief. It doesn't necessarily fix the story. It doesn't make the story go away. It doesn't transform mind, which itself is nothing but thought, into thoughtlessness. It does nothing whatsoever about my history. Nothing whatsoever about my story. What it does is it eradicates the false belief that is the basis and the source and the endless engine of my conviction that I need something that I don't have. That's what it does. It doesn't give you enlightenment. It doesn't give you self-realization. All that is at stake here is the truth of what I am, the reality of it, the actual nature of it. Now, we've heard a lot of things about what we are, actually, what our actual nature is. We are, as I've said, consciousness, we are love, we are happiness, we are peace, we are freedom, so forth and so on. But none of that's true. It's all words, all thought, all part of the story of me. Nothing whatsoever that has been ever said about what you are is true. It might be effective even in inflaming the fan of desire, to the flame of desire, to know the truth. But it ain't true, none of it. Knowing what you are is easy, is too strong a word, too heavy a word. Knowing what you are is, in fact, what you are. You are here. There is no one in this room who can, by any means whatsoever, by any mental or philosophical or metaphysical gymnastics, deny that they are here. Anybody think they're not here? Nobody, no human on the face of the planet can possibly say, oh, I am not. I can say, well, I'm emptiness or I am nothing, but I am not is beyond my capacity. I can say, you are not. That's actually relatively easy and a big part of the spiritual arena. You are not. I mean, after all, if you are, then there's this separation thing that has to be explained, right? But you are not. You are phantasms that appear in my consciousness. There's nothing there. But me, I am. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, I am. And there is no human being on the face of the planet that cannot consciously, deliberately taste this reality of being that is what you are. First of all, see that to be true. You can absolutely, in this moment, taste what it is to be. You can't say anything about it, but sure to God you can taste it. What is it that makes you so certain that you're here? What is the present experience that makes it impossible for you to deny your existence, your being? That's you. It's easy, easy. Every human being can taste this. And that is the self-inquiry of Ramana Maharshi. That momentary, repeated movement of conscious attention to this naked, radical, undefinable reality that I am. And that's all that it takes. I swear to God, that's all that it takes. But not in the way we've become accustomed to, saying that's all that it takes. You see, we have a lust for a final solution to things. We have a great lust that things once and for all be dealt with. And we entered the spiritual arena with that same lust. We have heard it said somewhere that it's possible to, well, just wake up and everything's over with. All the conflict, all the wanting, all the neediness, all the aggression, all the stupidity is over with. We have heard it said somewhere that either by diligent, dedicated effort to some meditative or physical practice, or by the energetic transmission from some guru entity, or by, I don't know, a bolt of lightning coming from the sky and striking us, that it's possible for there to be one instant when all that I know to be false is either eradicated or clarified. And we want that to be true despite our lifelong experience that tells us this is infantile. This is foolishness. The reason we want it to be so true is because our belief that what we are is the story of me is so powerful. You see that? Because if I am this storyline of the one who has striven and failed, aspired and not gotten, and so forth. If I am this storyline, then the only way that the spiritual aspiration can be of any use whatsoever is to fix this stinking story. But see, there's something else that's at the heart of all spiritual traditions whatsoever, and that is that you already are exactly just as you are. You already are what you want. You already are truth. You already are happiness, permanence, love without condition, without regard to anything having to do with the story. Now, here's my experience over the years since I first was, boy, I don't know even how to find a word to describe what happened to me in the meeting with Gangaji. But whatever that was, whatever that force of nature was that struck me down, my experience finally in this, I guess it's been 12 years next month. Finally, after years of looking in all the wrong places for what it was that Gangaji had offered to me, finally I came to see that all that's required is that whenever it's possible, whenever it occurs to you, no matter how often or seldom that might be, without doing anything whatsoever about your current practices, without stopping anything, starting anything, holding on to anything, letting go of anything, whenever it occurs to you, stop for just 1 second and consciously, with your attention, taste this reality that you know is here, that you know is what you are. That's all that's required. And the promise is that this repeated, intermittent, silly practice will wipe out, eradicate, and destroy the belief that you are anything whatsoever to do with the story that you have believed yourself to be. The good story, the bad story, the spiritual story, the awake story, the ignorant story, any of those stories. That's what this practice will do over time. Repeatedly, whenever it occurs to you, just stop for 1 second and taste this reality. And you'll see. And this knowing, this certainty, will saturate the story of you, permeate it, as it already does. It won't make the story the Buddha. It won't do away with stupidity. It won't do away with foolishness. It won't even do away with the desire to get what you don't have and to get rid of what you don't like. None of those things are relevant here. None of those things have anything whatsoever to do with you. But what it will do is eradicate for you the belief that you are that story, and end once and for all, finally, over time, end this deep-seated certainty that I am at stake in every thought that comes to mind, that I am at stake in every emotional experience that arises, in every experience of peace, in every experience of heartache, that it is my very self that's at stake here. And what it will do for you is end the war with yourself that is the source of all suffering, the source of all warfare, the source of all murderous intent whatsoever. The claim is that the only problem is a false belief about what we are, and the only solution is the truth of what we are. And further, the claim is that the truth of what we are is ever available, permanently here. And you know that. You know that you're permanent. You know that you've never changed. You know that nothing has happened to you ever. It is absolutely possible with the conscious mind, without any regard to whether it's ego or not ego or what in the world it is, it is absolutely possible with the conscious mind to taste this and see that it is, in fact, what you've always wanted. It is the water you have thirsted for all of your life. That's not, you know, I'm not very spiritual, but that's what I come to talk about. This simple, simple. And it works. That's the only advantage to it. It's not like, oh boy, yeah, I know why I like going to this guru because he makes me feel really good. Or I know why I like this teaching because it clarified things for me. It's not like that. It doesn't do any of that. What it does that none of the other things do is it works. It's the only thing that works. It's practical. Hi.
So when you first stopped, now do you stop? You know what I mean? Do you stop more?
What about you? Do you stop more or less?
A little bit more.
And what is it that stops and starts? What are you referring to when you say you stop or don't stop? And what are you? Do you stop? Have you ever started?
As soon as you begin to talk about any of it, it seems like it's...
It's because it is. It's all a story. Mm-hmm. You know, when you... In this moment, you can see what you are. Mm-hmm. Really. I mean, you're permanent. You've never changed. You never started. You never stopped. Mm-hmm. You're the background of all of it, and that's very clear. The rest of it's all story. It doesn't make it bad.
It's like I get it. I get what you're talking about, but then I like...
But so what? Yes, I know. But so what? What's the problem with that? You know where to go.
Yeah.
When you get lost, you know where to go. So what's the problem with I get... Who cares? The only reason that's a problem, that you must see that the only reason that that can possibly be a problem if that is you that goes off, Then there's some justification for wanting to do something about it because it's crazy. But it's not you.
Mm-hmm.
You see. And you know, and I know you know because of this meeting together here, you know where to find the truth, where to find the actuality of it. So if you go off for the next, 3 weeks, Yep, I want this, I don't want that. I wish it were different. I wish I had something. And then it occurs to you, wait a minute. Really? What am I? Really? All of that time spent chasing, not chasing, and so forth is irrelevant. It's of no consequence. The only time it's of any consequence is the time spent in direct, unmediated meeting with reality. The rest of it is of no consequence.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
It's nice to meet you finally.
Oh, it's very nice to meet you finally. Hi.
Hello.
I'm well. You?
Here. I said I'm here.
Yes, you are. That's right. That's the right answer.
I have been sitting, turning within, as you've talked about, doing whenever we get the opportunity. You mentioned this force of nature that you experienced with Gangaji. I guess here I have some thought that experience, a force of nature, as you called it, was so powerful.
That's necessary.
That it has took you to this point.
And that you haven't had it. And therefore, until you get that, you can't get what you really want.
That there is something that is deeper than a mere tasting it. When I sit and go within, that there is something that is...
Well, there may or may not be, okay? But it's kind of beside the point. Because the real... I tell you from my heart that the explosive meeting with Gangaji, the most immediate outcome of that was a year of suffering and misery. Okay? Unnecessary suffering and misery. And then another year of more unnecessary suffering and misery. So it is not really my experience that those big experiences are that helpful. except in so far, except in so far as it got my attention and enlivened in me an interest in the spiritual solution. That itself only goes so far, because as we've been talking about, what we generally do with that aspiration for the spiritual solution is more of the same. It is absolutely natural and absolutely to be expected that you would yearn after some explosive spiritual experience. It is absolutely natural. It is ordinary. It is what we do. It just doesn't have anything to do with what you are. With me, the explosive spiritual experience got my attention. With you, the deep yearning for that spiritual experience is the same. It's got your attention. It's got you seeking after a spiritual solution. And I tell you that there is no solution apart from ridding yourself of the idea that you are the one who wants and needs this spiritual experience. And that is very easy, because what you are is here. And you know it. You are here, right? And when you see the reality of what you are, what can be added to that or taken away from that? Let me be really clear. I am not advising you to rid yourself of the desire for an explosive spiritual experience. I am not advising you not to seek after those things. What I am suggesting to you is that it is beside the point. Keep doing it. But when you can, just for a second, see what you are. You are here. You are always here. You are here when there is this yearning, this absolute God-given yearning, and you are here when, well, it's the dishes that need to be done and the trash that needs to be taken out and the bills that need to be paid. You are here. And you can taste that anytime. And that's the medicine. I promise, that's the medicine. You may get big experiences, but if they come, they will go. Enjoy them while they're here. Don't mourn them when they go. And whenever you get a chance, look and see what you are.
Yes.
You see?
Yes.
Okay.
And?
That's all.
Thank you. And I hear what you're saying. I don't believe it's my truth that I'm searching for a spiritual experience, but more that there's a knowing that there is something that is calling, that is deeper. But it's not the experience. It's not an experience that I'm searching for. But there's a knowing of something.
That's true. That's true. That something is you. That something is you. Now, reflect on this for a minute, okay? You've never changed. Never. In all the time that you've been conscious of being, you've never changed. Like, I look in the mirror, and I see this 64-year-old geezer, and it takes me by surprise. Like, I haven't changed. The face has changed. The body's changed. The thoughts have changed, the experience have changed, but I haven't. I am exactly the same. Is that not your experience also?
That there is something in me that has not changed.
That's right. Okay. That's you. The fact that you have never changed, the fact that you are permanently here, that you are untouched and untouchable, makes you, the experience of you, what? Absolutely ordinary. And since what I am looking for is something deep and big and huge, this ordinariness cannot be it. But it is. just do this for me. In the next time, for the next period, once in a while, when you think of it, stop what you're doing, just for a second, and feel this, even now, with the hugeness of breath and heart and so forth. Is not this permanence here?
The permanence is here.
Yes. Unaffected, really, by the bigness. And the bigness is wonderful. You are not touched. The point is not to get rid of the good feeling. The point is to find the truth. So when you can, whether you're feeling really broken open or you're feeling really contracted, when it occurs to you, stop for a second and look at that permanence. Look at that reality. It'll have its way with you. I promise. What happens is that we discover very quickly when we engage in this that this is what we've been looking for. Oh, no, I know, that's just that. I want something deeper, I want something more. But we really, when we taste it, we know this is what we've been looking for. And since this is the claim, since this is what we've been looking for, once we know where to get it, we keep coming back to it. You see if that's not true.
Thank you.
Oh, you're really welcome. We always move into the idea that something is either the problem or the solution. Right? I mean, like the big broken openness is the problem or the solution. It's neither. It's just a big broken openness that appears in you, manifests in you for a while, and then disappears in you. Yes, right, of course not. And that's okay, not liking that. But what I'm telling you is that it's not you that's not liking its disappearance. And further, I'm telling you how to eradicate the idea that it is you, which isn't to get some new idea of what you are, but to taste the truth of what you are, again and again.
Hi, John.
Hi, what's your name?
Dane.
Dane?
Dane. I've been aware of this, as you point here, and Gloria was doing the same thing. This feeling, sensation, I guess, inside for several years. And I've done as well as I can do it, what you're suggesting. And I can't say that the shift in my ability to be present with people, ability to be more accepting and flowing and relaxed in life is specifically due to that, but I think it is.
I would say the same thing.
Yeah.
I would say I'm not sure of that either. But.
And I've gone so far as to write about it. I've taught other people about paying attention to this. And like Gloria and probably everybody else in here, I've also been thinking that there's something more.
Yes, right.
A whole lot bigger than that, that maybe this is just the tip of the iceberg. But I want to thank you for just pointing out the simplicity and the reminder of this experience as a touchstone.
There's two aspects to self-inquiry. And, you know, I have for some time now wished I could come up with some other expression than self-inquiry, which sounds to me, to my ears, kind of awkward and clunky and not very descriptive of what's offered, really. But I haven't come up with anything. If I ever do, I will make an announcement to that effect. But there's two aspects to self-inquiry. One is the one we have been speaking about here, which is the direct, unmediated tasting of the reality of what you are. And, of course, one of the thing that has to be seen is that it is what I am. In other words, if I just kind of blindly rest in the silence and the peace and so forth that's at my heart, believing all the while that I am resting in the silence and peace that's in my heart, and not that I am that silence and peace. It's another refuge, and it's okay, right? I mean, God knows we have enough trouble in these lives without being told that we're sinners for seeking a little bit of peace and cessation of struggle. But that is just the least of it. It is to taste this reality, knowing consciously that it's me. That's something entirely different. And that's the genius of Ramana's resurrection of this ancient practice. Is the genius of it is the insistence that this meeting with yourself be conscious and that it not be denied. When it's obvious that this is what I am, then the denial is just more self-betrayal, more addiction to suffering. That's one aspect of self-inquiry. There's another aspect, and self-inquiry goes entirely to the matter of clearing up this misunderstanding about what I am. It doesn't promise big spiritual experiences, although I tell you that they may well come, and they may well be not what you expected. But the whole point of self-inquiry is to clear up this misunderstanding about what I am. So the other aspect of self-inquiry, which Ramana talked about at least as often as he talked about what we've talked about so far, is discovering this that I believe myself to be, is inquiring into the actual nature of this knot of contraction and neediness and wanting and not getting that I believe myself to be. Ramana calls this ego. Well, he's not the first one to call it ego. Ramana goes further and calls it the I thought, which of course is just another way of saying ego. No difference. So the other thing that Ramana advises us to do, it's not necessary, but another possibility is to turn your attention with laser-like intensity to look for, without any spiritual, nonsense about who's looking for it and, all that infinite regression stuff, right? But to just look for some experience within you that answers to the name of neediness, contraction, selfishness, self-service, worthlessness, and stay with that. See what it is. Before the names, before the judgment, the non-verbal judgment, to see what it is, really. Ramana tells us that in this way, if we investigate ego, or the I thought, with absolute determination only to know the truth, not to get rid of it, not to fix it, not just to know the truth, that we will discover that at the core of this I thought, this ego is, I.
Sorry, little I?
I hate that. Doesn't seem to be anything I can do about it, but I hate it anyway.
I have felt a little confused at times.
Yeah.
That it seems to be you and then you.
Yes, right.
You're not the same you.
Right. Yeah. So Ramana's invitation in this regard is to find out what this that you're calling the small I is, really. What is this thing that wants this and doesn't want that and wants pleasure and avoids pain? Not to make it stop, not to do anything about it, but just to know the truth once and for all. You see, that's the way we engage in these spiritual practices mostly, universally, is we do it in order, to get feeling better. It doesn't occur to us that maybe what we really want to know is the truth. I mean, maybe that is me, that knot of temporary insanity. So those are the two faces of self-inquiry. In truth, they are the same. They're the two faces of self-inquiry. what we're after is the truth of what I am. And that truth can be revealed whether I look directly in the shining face of permanent, unmoving freedom that is me. Or I look in the infantile, knotted up, whining, sniveling, miserable knot of needs and not getting that I think I am. So there's no problem in wanting deeper and bigger experiences. Everybody wants deeper and bigger experiences. That's why the drug dealers make so much money. The only problem arises when I am caught in the belief that it is me that needs this deepening, this bigger experience, this enlightenment, this awakening. That it is me that's at stake here. That it says something about me. That I don't get this. That I'm stuck with this mere eternal shining awareness. And that's why I never advise anybody to stop anything they're doing. Because what we're doing, what we're seeking, and the seeking of it is beside the point. Nothing we have ever done to try to fix this need to get rid of has worked. Let's admit it. Nothing has worked. No spiritual practice, no therapeutic practice, no drugs, no sex, no rock and roll, no psychoanalysis has succeeded in stifling and silencing this ugly seed of wanting and needing and not getting and not wanting to be hurt and not wanting to be taken advantage of. I'm not suggesting we do anything about any of that. Just that we find out the truth. What am I, really? That we take at face value what we have been told by these gigantic beings, which is that this is all that's needed. That we call their bluff. Without the mediation of all the layers of writings and sutras and mantras and shastras and Upanishads and hymns and all of that, that just for a moment we put that aside and take them at their word and call their bluff and see whether it is true that I can know here and now in this moment the truth of my nature, and that if I stay there, my belief that I am the sniveling, suffering, needy one will vanish, and that all will be well, as it has always been. Okay?
There are times in like group situations where this consciousness is active, some magic that happens.
Yes, and I tell you what my experience is. My experience that all action and all interaction is always absolutely spontaneous, fresh, and innocent in the moment. What becomes the drag on the spontaneity is the after-the-fact commentary. You know?
Yeah.
Really. And, oh, wait a minute, I shouldn't have said that. That was wrong. Oh, well, I'm a really bad person to treat that person that way. But it's all, you know, we don't know what's happening. We don't know what we've thought until after we've seen it. We don't know anything until after the fact. Anything about the way these beings comport themselves, relate to each other, and so forth. But it's that really quick intervention of the one who wants to be right, wants to be good, wants not to have made a mistake, wants not to be taken advantage of, wants not to be seen wrongly. And that's all predicated on the belief that I am the one who is doing all of this. And I'm not. And I know that, and so do you.
I know it a little more now. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Dane. It's my pleasure. Jane. I'm so happy you came tonight.
When you walked in, I wanted to clap. And that's how it feels, you know. It's like you bump into people and you want to clap. Hmm. I don't have a question. I just feel like It feels like the more we try to inquire, the more it engages the mind. And this is for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, to me, it's just being really simple in living.
And what?
Living.
Mm-hmm.
And in that being present, there is so much love. I mean, there's just open love.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's anger. I mean, it's whatever it is there. So I've reached a point where I get a little like I'm getting more pissed off at all the language.
At all the?
Language.
Oh,
just
good.
Everything. Everything. Yeah. Everything. To me, it's like, stop. It's simpler than all this. And then I think, well, maybe I'm doing something wrong because I'm not doing anything.
Are you happy?
I am happy, yes.
Then why would you want to do anything?
Well, for self-inquiry purposes.
And what do you get from that that you don't already have?
What did you just say?
What do you get from that you don't already have?
Just probably more judgment rather than just the...
And who's making the judgment?
The mind, the ego.
Well, Jane's making the judgment.
Know.
But and why is it a problem, this judgment?
I don't find it a problem.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's the point. That's my point. It's not a problem.
Yeah, it's not a problem.
It's not a problem. If you judge yourself, it's not a problem. If you judge the guy that cut you off on the freeway, that's not a problem. It's only a problem if it's, well, me, and it means something about me.
I mean, I definitely have moments of, you know, thinking, I wish I was different, or, oh, my God, this is here, and I'd like to be this way instead of this way.
And what's the problem with that?
Nothing. I mean,
there it is.
That's just there.
There it is.
But, you know, I just think the more I've been, you know, seeing people, you know, I'm in love with everyone. You know, there's just like, you know, we don't know each other's personalities, really. We're really connecting to the truth in each other, that core nakedness that's beyond the personality. And that's everywhere, you know. That's in the grocery store, and
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah. So I just want to say hi and
hi.
Welcome you. And
you know, it's really my point is that there is no problem. That's my point, and that if we think there is a problem and we suffer and fuss over it, then there is a really simple solution to that. Let's find out what I am. All the rest of it is just jabber. All the rest of it.
I think knowing, you know, understanding the Enneagram and how it plays out more has been a way to just see the operating manual.
And what good does that do?
Well, it's actually like that awareness can make me not think of me as like it. Like it separates me out from taking it as if I am me. It's also just another layer of personality. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, not entirely. Please, dear God, don't let me get into any kind of a negative discussion of the Enneagram here in Nashville. Please, spare me that.
Good luck.
I don't have any problem with you. I don't have any problem with any practice whatsoever, okay? That's really the truth. I really don't care what anybody does with their spiritual practice, with their worldly practice, because it's very apparent to me that that's beside the point. It really is, completely beside the point. There is no need to defend nor to attack any spiritual practice whatsoever. None. And if it makes you feel better, then that's fine with me too, really. I have no problem with that. I have to say, because I am enjoined by Gangaji to tell the truth, I have to say that I don't see the point of all the work on the Enneagram. And let me tell you why that is so. Because of my own experience with the Enneagram. I said earlier tonight when I was speaking with you that the explosive experience that came to me in the meeting with Gangaji was the beginning of 2 years, really, of suffering and misery, of heartache and wanting and not getting, of knowing I wasn't what I was pretending to be and continuing to pretend to be that, only to hold her attention and her love. And that's the truth. The second year was trying to make amends for the first year. In the midst of all of this, I was given a copy of the Enneagram book when it was spiral bound plastic covers and so forth. And since in those days I knew what was right and what was wrong, I really was, you know, I knew what was spiritually correct and what was spiritually incorrect. I knew that the Enneagram was spiritually incorrect. I knew that. It was obvious to me. I mean, after all, we are infinite, shining awareness. What use do we have for this meddling about in the matters of the personality and the mind? I was such an insufferable, arrogant ass. Of course, putting that in the past tense hopefully will make you think that that's no longer the case. In any event, I was given this Enneagram book, and I had heard about it. You know, I was in prison, so I didn't have the day-to-day contact with the Sangha that everybody else did, but I was pretty well known in the Sangha, and people wrote to me and sent me stuff and so forth and came to visit me. And I looked at that book, and I had it on my bunk, and I would circle it like a dog circling a suspicious bone. I'd pick it up, and I would start reading it, and I read the introduction, and I would read a little bit, and I would come to some part that seemed to me to be so egregiously wrong that I would throw it down on the bunk and not pick it up again for several days. This went on for a while. I remember when I came to the diagrams of the personalities and so forth, and that really set me off. But I was persuaded that since there was such authentic support for this system, I was persuaded that, and of course, since I really wanted Gangaji to stay in love with me, and I knew that she had something to do with this, I was determined to get to understand what it was and to understand what it was about. Well, as it happened in that volume, in that edition of the Enneagram book, the 9 fixation appeared first. And I started reading this description of the 9 fixation. And I was stunned. I mean, because on 2 levels. One is that it was really obvious that what Eli was describing was basically a cartoon character, with no depth, no substance, no nothing of any importance whatsoever, just a two-dimensional cartoon character that wasn't really very interesting as personalities go. You know, all the nine wants to do is, well, avoid conflict, is to keep everything quiet, not to bring up the Enneagram book in Ashland. But the other part of that explication of the nine personality fixation was that it was me. I mean, it was me. Totally me. I mean, and I was stunned at this in an entirely non-spiritual way, because I had been in love with me by this time for, what, 56 years or so. I had spent all of my waking hours doing nothing but examining me, understanding me, investigating me, trying to predict me, trying to fix me, trying to... just this magnificent lifelong love affair with me. And yet, here, it is a cartoon character, and it's me. For a couple of days, I walked around really befuddled by that. I really was quite disturbed. I couldn't make sense of it. I knew the lushness and the depth and the sweetness and the ugliness of me. I knew it was not a cartoon character. And then one day, I was walking to the mess hall, still with this conflict going on in my so-called mind. And suddenly it hit me. I am a cartoon character. That's really the truth. I am a cartoon character. And I laughed. I burst out in raucous laughter in the middle of the prison yard on the way to the mess hall. No doubt, but I was already seen to be a weirdo in those days. I had lost all of my previous cred. Street cred when I became a spiritual guy. And that seeing that, just that, was all that I ever needed from the Enneagram. I never had to give another thought to what the nine fixation does, to how it's connected with the eight and the this one and that one. Never again did I ever give another thought to understanding the nine fixation. That was all that I needed from the Enneagram. That bursting of the lifelong love affair with what was actually, obviously, really obviously, just a flat, two-dimensional cartoon character. So that's my view of the Enneagram. It's a wonderful thing, but just for that. And it is my suspicion that continuing to pay attention, such close attention to what personality does, is not very useful. It's not wrong. It can't hurt you. Nothing can hurt you. It's just not very useful. So there.
Well, I just want to clarify. I think where it's useful in my life, and I don't use it, I don't, you know, chew on it and do the whole self-inquiry.
Enneagram isn't self-inquiry.
It's a way to investigate what's running you.
It's not self-inquiry.
But nonetheless, to me, what's useful is that you can see the joke of it.
Yeah, but it's
I'm in relationship and I can laugh at something that's so like part of the habit, that's where I can depersonalize.
Yes, but once you've seen the joke, well, it's not funny anymore. I mean, it's just funny for that 1 second. And then it's just, you know, I mean, if you read the same cartoon over and over again, do you laugh at it every time? Unfortunately, we're at the end of our time.
Yeah. Thank you.
But I don't want you to think anything except... Nothing you do can hurt you. That's really the truth. Nothing you do can hurt you. No amount of spiritual seeking, no amount of honoring the idea that you need something that you don't have, none of that can hurt you in the least. It has no effect on you. It cannot touch you. Really. If you will, whenever it occurs to you, if you will, just for a second, consciously rest your attention into this permanent reality that you are, all will be well. It won't look like you expect it to. It doesn't mean you'll stop chasing spiritual experience. It doesn't mean anything except that you will not suffer again. Thank you. Thank you for this satsang. Om Shanti.